Now, while a number of those essay competition winners tackled questions about the role that quantum physics played in the evolution of life, last year, astrophysicist Bernard Schütz at Cardiff University in the UK and his colleagues published a paper in the journal Zygon connecting aspects of relativity to biology. They claim that gravitational waves, or ripples in space-time, were essential for the evolution of human cognition. Reporter Miriam Frankel interviewed Schütz about this highly speculative theory, but before getting to his scientific research, she asked him about his role co-founding the journal Living Reviews in Relativity in the late 1990s, often dubbed the Wikipedia of science.
In 1998, Bernard Schütz, who was then at the Max Planck Institute and now at the University of Cardiff, had a groundbreaking idea. He decided to launch a purely online, fully open access journal of review articles, so articles that give a comprehensive overview of the research in a certain area. What's more, he decided that the articles should be updated over time as new research came out. The journal, called Living Reviews in Relativity, became a success and one of the most cited review journals out there. The idea caught on, with a journal developing into a series, which is now owned by Springer, including Living Reviews in Solar Physics and Living Reviews in Computational Astrophysics. I started by asking Schütz how he came up with the idea in the first place.
I was one of the two founding directors for this Max Planck Institute. So originally, it was conceived of as a good way of allowing new research students to come in and get up to speed very quickly. We were in a field, general relativity, that had been very small, that was expanding quickly because gravitational wave detectors were being built, and suddenly also black holes and other things that were coming out of Einstein's theory were becoming central to astronomy. And there wasn't a review literature for general relativity that was at all comprehensive. So we thought we're filling a gap for our subject. We didn't really think of being a pioneer and trying to help other subjects. We just thought for general relativity, this is the best way we can do to get our students a literature that they can use to get into the subject.
You showed how a living review journal could actually work successfully. So why aren't these types of journals everywhere in science?
I think some have started up and then fallen by the wayside because the model is not commercial. You're not charging money in either way. It does require you to put in resources. And this is one of the things that I think, you know, more broadly in the current concern about how scientific publishing operates, and particularly I'm concerned, as many others are, about the way scientific publishing is used by a small number of commercial publishers to make big profits. I would like to see more scientific institutions taking responsibility as we did. But, you know, the way money is distributed, allocated to science by government funding and so on, is usually not generous enough to allow that. And I think that's why some of these startup journals found it difficult to continue to operate.
How hard is it to get people to write these reviews, given that, you know, they aren't paid, they're not necessarily even writing about their own research?
The review journal, again, is a lot of work and not particularly rewarding in the sense that if you take the amount of work it takes to write a review, you might publish 10 research papers during that time that might be better for your career. Mm-hmm. So it's something that people do out of a sense of responsibility to their science, not to their career, and also to their own students and so on. But that's something that we take advantage of when we run a review journal, and we look for authors, we invite authors. And if it's a prestigious journal, as Living Reviews has become, then people are, you know, they're sort of honored to be asked to write, and we get a fair rate of acceptance.
The Living Review series is sometimes compared to Wikipedia. Do you think that's fair?
We had Origins at around the same time, and it seemed obvious to me, if I don't have a paper copy, then why not take advantage of the fact that I can update an article? And that has proved very, very attractive because you put in a lot of work. The update is not nearly as much work as the original review. But if you don't update it, then after about 5 years, people are going to stop looking at it because the field has moved on.
Do most people actually update their articles, or do some people write the living review and then sort of forget about it?
It depends very much on the person. We said to people, well, if you don't want to update, do you mind if we change to a different authorship and allow them to continue your article? But we keep your name on it, but we add other people's names.
Right. So not anyone can update them. You have to be an author.
That's right. We struggled for a while with what is an article? If an article is updated, is it the same article or not? And that's important for, you know, citation counting and things like that. After talking with a number of organizations, we finally adopted the policy that every update is technically a new article.
How long are they typically?
A lot of them are over 100 pages. Once somebody decides they're going to write on something that is close to their heart, I was totally amazed because it's a rod for their own back when they have to go and review it.
Springer took over your journal in 2015. Did you have any qualms about joining such a mega publisher?
Yes, but it wasn't in my control anymore. I was retiring. So I was very worried by it, but I think it's worked out very well. And I have a lot of respect for the way that Springer has seen it as something which has enough prestige that they like having it in their stable. Springer knew they were taking on something that would lose money because they also realized it would be very hard to charge open access fees to the author. But they have been publishing it now for about 10 years. They publish another journal in relativity, the GRG journal, General Relativity and Gravitation Journal, which is a subscription journal. They make money from that. So they combine the two editorial streams. And so Living Reviews doesn't create much overhead for them. So they can pay for it basically with the income they get from the other journal in the same field.
Could you tell us a little about what your own research is about?
I put a paper on the archive with a couple of colleagues on gravitational waves and human evolution. So
that sounds
making
really
the case.
Interesting.
It's a curious thing. It's amusing, but also a serious statement, making the case that if you look in detail about how humans evolved, and in particular, how something like 3 million years ago, suddenly the genus Homo appeared and the intelligence started to increase. Before that, we weren't that much different from our chimpanzees' cousins. But about 3 million years ago, things started to change and led eventually to this crazy species that dominates the world now. And that change 3 million years ago probably not have happened if Newton's theory of gravity was the right theory of gravity. In other words, there was no gravitational waves.
Okay, that sounds really... What? How?
We detect gravitational waves because they're emitted by binary systems of very dense relativistic objects like black holes or neutron stars that are in very tight orbits around one another. And the gravitational waves, from the point of view of that system, are carrying energy away. And inevitably, they bring the two objects together at some point, crashing together. And that's what we have been observing. And when you have two neutron stars, we observed the first time we observed two neutron stars merging together in this scenario. That was in 2017. It validated something that people had predicted, which was that the explosion of the two neutron stars that results as a lot of material is kicked off. But that material ultimately just becomes the very heaviest elements that we know of in our periodic table of elements. And in particular, it validated the proposition that our periodic table has two origins. The lighter elements going from hydrogen up to about iron come out of supernova explosions, but the heavier ones above iron typically come from merging of binary neutron stars and maybe also neutron stars and black holes. And that wouldn't happen without gravitational waves. And so if Newton had been right, you'd still have supernova explosions because the nuclear physics would do it all, but you'd only have half the periodic table. Now, some of the upper half contains elements that are very important to us, like iodine, for example. However, there's two elements that are irreplaceable in this story. Those elements are uranium and thorium. They have radioactive isotopes that are very long-lived, like billions of years. Those isotopes were in the cloud of gas that formed the Earth, and they were incorporated into the body of the Earth, and they're still decaying very slowly. But it turns out that the heat that they generate with their decays, geologists seem to believe that that heat is necessary for plate tectonics. The continents would have frozen maybe a billion years ago if it wasn't for this continued decay. It's already very interesting, I think, that we wouldn't have so much of earthquakes, volcanoes, continued ocean spreading and all of that if Newton's gravity were the right theory of gravity, if we didn't have Einstein's gravitational waves. But that also has implications for evolution because plate tectonics is one of the main drivers of evolution. It's constantly changing, particularly for land-based life. It's constantly changing the environments and forcing animals and plants to adapt to new environments as the land they live on, you know, goes up to the pole or goes somewhere else or gets very wet or whatever. So evolution has certainly had a lot of input from plate tectonics. But now we come to the 3 million years ago. And 3 million years ago was North and South America finally completed their joining up through the Isthmus of Panama. Up until that point, they were close, but there was still a gap, and there were ocean currents between the Pacific and the Atlantic. There was a big current going from the Pacific into the Atlantic, containing, you know, rather warm, it's equatorial, rather warm water. When about 3 million years ago, the isthmus was risen up and deposits came and so on, that blocked that current. And then the water had to go somewhere. So it went around the bottom of South America and up into the Atlantic. But going down there, it cooled off, and so it changed the climate. There was a big climate change, in particular in Africa. It got significantly cooler, several degrees, and wetter. This was a challenge to all life in Africa, but particularly to our ancestors, probably the Australopithecines, who were upright and they had hands, but they were very small, and they may probably even have been still sleeping in the trees. But the problem is the trees started going away. The savanna began to expand, much more grassland, much smaller forests. And so some of them stayed out in the grassland, and apparently to adapt, this again is not my theory, this is what people who study evolution believe, to adapt, it started out all the changes. They got taller, they got more upright, even better hands, and brains started growing and all of that. And it's another interesting and little known fact that we didn't have ice ages the way we have them now. We have regular ice ages, and they're caused by small changes in the Earth's orbit that are due to the gravitational interaction of the Earth with other planets. So sometimes the Earth orbit is a little bit more eccentric, sometimes it's a little more rounder. But it turns out that because the temperature was lowered by this event of joining in North and South America, we are just at a marginal point where those small changes in the orbit then can make all the difference between having an ice age because the temperature was lowered. Before, when the temperature was higher, you didn't have that. Of course, even when there's ice in just in North America, that cools off Africa. It changes the African climate as well. And so humanity, the Homo species that started up in Africa after this first event, they never had a chance to settle down. It just kept driving evolution, these periodic changes in climate. And so eventually produced us with our brains. And so it's just that without gravitational waves, none of that would have happened.
Thank you to Bernard Schutz for chatting with Miriam Frankel. I'm putting links to an article that Miriam wrote about the impact of living reviews in relativity on science journals as a whole on the podcast page qspace.fqxi.org/podcasts. I'm also linking to Schutz's paper on gravitational waves and evolution. That's all for today. Thank you again to Gabriella Freitag, Rishabh Ghosh, Gerard McCall, Michael Montague, Aswati Prakash, Tekapurakal Prakashan, and Gabe Fitzpatrick, and to Bernard Schutz and Miriam Frankel. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and to our YouTube channel, and find us on socials where, amongst other great stuff by Gabe, you can watch some reels with our essay competition winners. You'll find us everywhere as either FQXI or FQXI Physics. You can also reach us the old-fashioned way, emailing podcast@fqxi.org. Thank you for listening. I've been Zia Morali.